This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk, and for Mike Collins. There's a problem on I-77 that everyone agrees on. Traffic is horrible, and it's getting worse. And that's where the agreement ends. The state wants to solve the problem by adding toll lanes, and it signed a contract with a private company to build and manage the lanes. State transportation leaders declined our repeated invitations to join the show this morning. But one of the people who helped come up with the idea for privately financed toll lanes is with us. Bob Poole is director of transportation policy at the Reason Foundation, a conservative think tank. He joins us over the phone from Florida. Bob, welcome.
Thanks very much, Michael. Good to be here.
Wyden I-77 is the group that's suing the state over this project. We invited the group's leader, Kurt Naas, to join us this morning. We gave him the option to join us over the phone because of the snow, but he declined. So if you have questions about the project, if you're for or against it, we'd love to hear from you. Search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. We also have Charlotte City Councilman Al Austin on the phone. He represents the district that includes a lot of the project. Al, welcome.
Good morning.
Before we get into the pros and cons, let's explain the basics of how this would work. It would add toll lanes in a 26-mile stretch of I-77 from Uptown to Iredell County. Bob, what are the options drivers would have with those lanes?
They would have the option of either being in a carpool that would get free passage or paying a toll that varies depending on how congested things are. And that's a choice that people would make, would have the opportunity to make every day. And if they're going someplace that where it's really important to be there, many of them would probably on that particular day choose to pay the toll. But if it's marginal, they might decide, well, no, I'd rather stick with the congestion and just take my chances with that.
And it's adding one to two lanes based on where you are in that stretch. And you could also just stay in the general purpose lanes for free.
Absolutely. All the general purpose lanes that are there now will remain exactly as they are.
And Al, what have you heard from constituents about this project?
Well, I'll tell you, when I began running for city council in 2013, I began to hear the rumblings from definitely the group Wyden I-77, as well as some of my constituents kind of really inside the Charlotte City Council to district area. It seemed at the point that when I arrived and had been in office about a year, that our focus has been on kind of mitigating some of the impact of the widening. The community, particularly one of my environmental injustices group, is really concerned about the widening as it relates to more noise in the communities and neighborhoods along 77, as well as the pollution and carbon dioxide that will be expended from vehicles and those things coming into the area. So I haven't got an overwhelming outcry from my community, but definitely it's there. There's some concerns. I have my own concerns as well.
And what are your concerns?
I think this is going to create a lane that's going to be only really for the wealthy. We're talking about charging what I believe, I've seen numbers of extraordinary prices for people to get through, and then I think the lanes are just going to kind of sit there when we're going to have other lanes that are going to be packed.
Well, off of that point, there was a study in 2012 by a state transportation consultant that estimated a round trip between Mooresville and Charlotte with the new lanes could cost about $22. Now, the private company that's going to be running this and the state say that that number is outdated, but they have not provided even a general range of what it may cost. I spoke to some Mooresville residents at a public meeting on the project a few months ago. Susan Robertson was really concerned about those lack of specifics. Here's what she had to say.
But when I hear things like $20 from Mooresville to Charlotte, possibly, I mean, they're like, oh, we don't know, we'll figure it out. You know, I don't like it, we'll figure it out. I want to know now. $20 a day, that's $100 a week for people. That's a lot of money.
Bob, this general concern that it could end up being essentially a fast lane,
right,
for rich people, has that happened elsewhere?
Opponents call it elsewhere. This concern arises every place in the country when these are first proposed. And it's an understandable concern. Let me first give you some perspective on it. There's no way the company can tell you what the price will be, because the whole idea of this kind of project is it's a variable toll that is not set by the company or the DOT. It's a variable depending on how bad the traffic congestion is. The idea is to use a price that's just high enough to ensure that the toll lanes will always be free-flowing, even at the worst of the rush hour. And what we find, so $20 round trip per day might be true sometime in the future at the very busiest hour if somebody made the trip at the peak of the peak, say the 15-minute period in the morning and the 15-minute period in the afternoon when the congestion was absolutely at its maximum. That might be the case. But it's entirely up to how much the demand is in the corridor. The other thing, let me just point out, I know people are concerned about, this would be harder for people on low incomes to afford. That's certainly true. But what we find in Seattle, in Orange County, California, in Miami, in Atlanta, in Dallas, all the places where these lanes exist and have been accepted, is that the vast majority of people only use them maybe one or two trips a week, one way, for a particular trip where it's really important to be there on time. And the classic example is, say, a parent who has kids in daycare. And I don't know about Charlotte, but most parts of the country, they charge very high late fees if you don't get there in time to pick up your kid. They can be as much as a dollar a minute in many places. So if the toll, let's say, at a rush hour in the afternoon is $7 to go, the full length or whatever people have to do, and they're likely to be 15 minutes late if they take the regular lanes, that would be $15 late fee versus a $7 toll. That's an obvious choice that anybody of any income level would probably make that choice.
I understand that the whole point is for the pricing to vary so that you can, of course, encourage people to use it. But why can't you at least give a general range of what it would be?
They could give a range of what exists on all the other express toll lanes in other communities. But the problem is until it's out there and people have a chance to get familiar with it, they really don't have a good idea. I mean, they obviously have a hope that the revenue will be enough to pay off the bonds that are going to be issued for the project and to cover the operating costs and so forth. But that's a guess, and the company is taking that risk, not the taxpayers.
Go ahead, Al.
I would think that since they've done these projects in many different places, they should be able to run some numbers and run some variables based on the traffic, because I'm sure they've done some traffic studies.
They absolutely have done traffic studies.
Right, they should be able to come up with a more defined number so that the public will be aware and people can get a better understanding of it. Let me also say this. I understand the need to widen 77 and the capacity of getting cars in the city. But I also think broadly, we need to start thinking about other options of transportation. We're not going to be able to handle all of the cars trying to get into our city anymore. We need to start looking at light rail. We need to look at other options. We had a wonderful 2030 plan that talked about light rail. I think it was called the Red Line. We've got the Blue Line, we've got the Red Line, the Gold Line, and all of these different things. We need to look at other options of moving people around this region. We're not going to be able to accommodate cars like we used to. Charlotte has grown. The region has grown. We've got more and more people living downtown, working downtown. We really need to start thinking about people, getting people to the city without cars.
Councilman, let me suggest something that is actually happening in Miami, which is near where I live, and in a number of other places that have put in the express toll lanes. An express toll lane is a two-for-one deal. You not only get a new option for people who drive, giving them a chance to bypass congestion, but it's also an option for faster and more reliable express bus travel. And we have seen in South Florida, between Fort Lauderdale and Miami, since the express lanes on I-95 have went in about 4 years ago, a quadrupling of express bus service and passengers between Fort Lauderdale and its suburbs and downtown Miami, which is a huge employment center.
But to get to Al's point, I mean, Al, is there money to, for example, do more with light rail or do more things that would take cars off of the road?
Sure. Well, I think, one of the things I've been championing for our community is our Goldlinks line that goes from east and west, and I know that's not necessarily 77, but that's giving us other options so that people won't have to drive, won't have to bombard our communities with more and more cars. So I think the 2030 funding identified to carry it out. And I believe that's MUMPO, one of those groups there that's kind of looking at that, and how do we find funding to support those plans, that plan.
I also want to point out that we asked representatives from the company that's going to be running this. The parent company is Centra, which is Spanish, mm-hmm. and there's a subsidiary company sure. called I-77 Mobility Partners. We asked them to be on the show, and they declined our request as well. But just to read a comment, the idea of a private company managing these, Colin on Facebook says, outsourced tolls, just like Florida, I'll pay $0 in tolls. He won't use it. Gas and other associated vehicle taxes are high enough. I do want to at least get a word in from the company. Jean Lear is a spokeswoman for the subsidiary of the Spanish company here. And I spoke to her a few months ago, and here was her point on this dynamic pricing and the tolls.
It would be a deterrent for us to set the tolls prohibitively high, because the whole point is for people to use those lanes. And so with the dynamic pricing, we are also mandated to keep that 45-mile-an-hour minimum speed limit in there. So the tolls will be dynamic, because the more people that are using the lanes, you have to guarantee that 45-miles-per-hour minimum. So you may see an increase in price.
Bob, that 45-mile-per-hour minimum, how has that worked elsewhere? Has that meant that the lanes actually do stay free-flowing?
Yes. I mean, every one of the express toll lanes that's now in operation, and this is on the Capitol Beltway outside of Washington, D.C., on I-95 in Northern Virginia, I-95 in Miami, one in Seattle, one in San Diego, one that's open now in Dallas, and a number of others that have been converted from HOV lanes. All of them are meeting, using the dynamic pricing is working very well to keep the traffic free-flowing. In fact, on most of these, most of the time it flows at more like 65 miles per hour rather than 45. The 45 is a federal standard that states that have built HOV lanes or converted or have these express lanes that also allow HOVs to ride free. They must maintain at least 45 miles per hour speed during rush hours 90% or more of the time. If they don't, the feds can threaten to withhold money, but the remedies are either to use pricing to manage the traffic flow or to increase the occupancy level for free passage from whatever it is to at least one person higher per car.
And we're talking that minimum is in the new lanes, correct? It's not like the entire highway.
It's in the new lanes. It's in the lanes that give preference to HOVs. Yes.
You know, the other concern I have is this Spanish company, and I'm told that they did they not go into bankruptcy?
No, they did not go into bankruptcy. The the Indiana Toll Road, which they have a part, they have 50% of the operating company that leased that from the state of Indiana. That operating company did go into bankruptcy, and
so has that project been produced or delivered to the community?
Well, that project was an existing toll road that the concession was to upgrade it. They added some lanes where there was a lot of congestion. They also converted from cash tolling to all electronic tolling.
We'll need take a short break here, Bob. We'll pick that point up, Al, on the other end, and explain what happened with that Indiana road and how it's similar and how it's different to what's proposed in Charlotte, because there are some key differences as well. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Love, Loss, and What I Wore, based on Eileen Beckerman's bestseller, an intimate collection of Nora and Delia Ephron stories, March 3rd through 8th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, sustainability. It's something we hear a lot about, and many of us try to make little changes in our daily habits to conserve resources and use energy in smart ways. As it turns out, cities are doing the same thing. There's a new strategy underway in Uptown to make Charlotte a smart city. But what does that mean? What makes a smart city? We'll check in with people behind this new effort and find out how technology is making cities, including Charlotte, more livable, workable, and sustainable. That's when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the next chapter in the battle over net neutrality. An expected new ruling from the FCC to regulate the Internet as a public utility. What blocking faster access to some types of data could mean for providers, businesses, and consumers.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk in for Mike Collins. We're discussing the proposed toll project for I-77. Al Austin is a Charlotte City Councilman. Bob Poole is one of the people who helped come up with the concept back in the late 1980s. Representatives from the State Department of Transportation and the group Widen I-77 declined our interview requests. We're also joined this segment by my WFAE colleague, Duncan McFadden. Hey, Duncan.
Good morning.
To finish up the point we were on, guys, I've heard a lot of questions about this Indiana bankruptcy, and it was a subsidiary company of Centra, so not Centra, but a subsidiary company. It was an all-toll lane. So whereas this would be you have some general-purpose lanes and some toll, this was an entirely toll project. But yes, it did in fact go bankrupt. Bob, what I'm wondering is the projects that are more similar to this one, where you have a mix of toll lanes and general-purpose lanes, how many of those have gone bankrupt?
None of those have gone bankrupt. Several of them have had struggles with early years of the traffic being less than they forecast. But none of those have gone bankrupt, which is a good sign, at least, that in general the model seems to be a viable one. The oldest one of these that I helped start in California opened to traffic in December of 1995, so the end of this year it'll be 20 years old. And that project has worked like a charm. It was those lanes were added to one of the most congested freeways in Southern California. They have flowed freely at the speed limit during rush hours for almost 20 years now. The variable pricing just works. That was the model that led to most of the others around the country.
Have many of them been challenged in court?
No. In fact, this may be there have been some challenges against other tolling projects, like one in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia that's building a new toll tunnel under river between, I think, Portsmouth and one other city. That one went all the way to the state Supreme Court. It was also a public-private partnership, and the people challenging it argued that Virginia had illegally or unconstitutionally delegated taxing power to a private company on the grounds that the toll was equal to a tax. And the Virginia Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the toll is not the same as a tax. They outlined three key differences that distinguish a toll from a tax, and that it was perfectly proper for Virginia DOT to delegate certain aspects of such a project, but retaining control over key decisions and standards through a very detailed long-term contract that is similar to what I presume that the North Carolina DOT has negotiated or is negotiating with Centra for the I-77 project.
So there will be a similar debate in courts here in North Carolina now that the group Widen I-77 has filed that lawsuit.
I imagine so.
When they did so, I spoke to the group's attorney, Matt Arnold, and to your point, Bobby said that it's tough to find another case across the country, he said, that is similar to the argument that they're making here. Here's a part of the conversation I had with him. It was outside of his Uptown law office, so you'll hear some traffic noise.
There haven't been too many instances where projects like this have been challenged across the country, but there have been a few, and obviously we've analyzed those and compared them to this project.
Can you give us at least some sort of general idea of how this is unconstitutional?
There are a number of issues that we raise about delegation of powers. There are issues that we raise about certain of the contract provisions, and there are, I think, four or five different ways in which we contend that the state has unconstitutionally delegated its taxing authority and failed to provide appropriate limitations on the taxing powers that it has delegated.
So this is something that will be playing out. Arnold said it could take up to another year before we even really make a lot of progress in this case.
It sounds like they're using a similar argument to the one that was used in Virginia.
Right. Well, as this plays out, I mean, we also, let's remember, this is not the only type of this kind of project that is planned in our general area. And my colleague Duncan McFadden has been reporting some on these. Let's start with this empty lane on I-485. What's the story there?
Well, basically, basically, the DOT says they finished that widening project of roughly I-77 to Ray Road. They finished it about 2 years early. And when they built that project, it was cheaper to add this lane that's supposed to become a toll lane in a couple of years when the rest of the project opens. The problem is now people are driving by. These lanes are closed off. They look like you can drive in them.
Right,
and
just
they're
sitting
calling,
there.
Yeah, they're calling people.
Exactly.
Like, I'm sure Al is getting calls from people saying, why can't
exactly
I drive
well
in this lane?
Exactly.
Al,
well,
are you hearing that?
Yeah. North Carolina, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Al.
Okay. Yeah, the North Carolina Secretary of Transportation actually came down and did a presentation to council most recently, and that was kind of the resounding sound of the community. Why can't we get into these lanes? And they're so frustrated because, you know, traffic in the southeast part of Charlotte is just horrendous at times. And so the community has been sending us emails after emails trying to resolve this.
And Duncan, why can't you get into that lane?
Well, it's because it wasn't supposed to be open yet. So the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization approves all these projects. And when they approved this one, based on the original timeline, of course, which meant the lanes would have been closed still for a couple of years, they decided it would be easier just to leave it closed.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, now we're looking at maybe 4 years of it being closed. So they were going to revisit that decision sometime in March, next month. And they've got three options. They can leave it closed, which seems like kind of a non-starter based on what we've been hearing. They can open it as a high occupancy vehicle lane or a carpool lane that retains the option to use it for tolls later. Or they could open it as a general purpose lane, but that causes all kinds of problems with future funding because you can't turn it back into a toll lane once it's been opened as general purpose.
Based on the state laws.
Right. Federal law, actually.
Oh, federal
literally
law.
Take an act of Congress to, if it's a general purpose lane, to turn it back into a toll lane.
Well, so this one empty lane.
Likewise, if you start it as a carpool lane, an HOV lane, you can't turn it. Eventually, you can't later turn that back into a GP general purpose lane either. That's federal law. Also.
Okay. So basically, it's sitting there because we need to decide
right
once and for all what's going
to
happen
what to
it.
Do
but
with it.
Right. So that lane beside, though, I mean, because of the funding situation that our State Department of Transportation has, they've emphasized a lot that that's a big reason we're looking at these projects. Is this something where we could be seeing these types of, you know, part general purpose, part toll lanes projects popping up more often?
Right. Well, the DOT in the Charlotte area, at least, is studying sort of three areas, I-77, obviously, 485 in the southeast part of the area, and then US 74. Actually, we're in the midst of a project. All the construction out on Independence, US 74 right now. We're in the midst of turning the bus lanes there that are sort of cordoned off, turning those into high occupancy and eventually toll lanes there. So the idea is if someone who lives, say, off of Johnston Road can hop onto 485, go up to 74, all on express lanes and all the way into 277 and uptown without having to leave the express lanes. That's what the state is looking at doing. Of course, there are multiple segments to this and all kinds of different hurdles that have to clear before that happens.
Al, what does the Charlotte City Council think of this idea of increasing tolls?
I don't think we have a collective body response to that. I think different district representatives have their own concerns. In fact, as I have with mine, my community has expressed their concerns over various number of things. And I think that the organization-wide in I-77 has been very adamant about their desire not to have this done. So I think it kind of depends on how it impacts certain districts. The presentation that was made by, I believe, Warren Coakley some months ago, there were concerns about the flyovers that are going to be landing kind of as you're coming down 77 over into 277 into the roadway. How is that going to happen? I don't know if we have a collective voice on that, if it's individual.
Okay.
Individual council members.
And a point I want to finish on as far as this project is the state has laid out one of the arguments they've made for it is, you know, worst case scenario, the company can't raise as much money as it wants. The state has to kick in more money. We'll be on the hook for $163 million. And Warren Cooksey, to your point, Alan, that meeting that you just referenced said that worst case scenario, you have $163 million, 26 miles of improvements that you just could not get for $163 million. It would basically be a discount. But some of the Mooresville residents that I spoke to a couple months back had their own take on that. For example, here is Carl Schwab.
Okay, on one end, the taxpayers are paying X dollars to the state to pay that $168 million. Well, the taxpayers are paying Y amount out of their own pocket to make up the difference in tolls. So it's the taxpayers who are still being burdened.
Bob, what do you think of that? So, the state is saving some money, but we taxpayers are still paying down the line.
Well, no, it's not we as taxpayers that are paying, because a tax is mandatory. A toll is optional. So only people who are paying the tolls are those who decide it's worth paying the tolls.
They're going to afford to do so.
Well, yes, but as I pointed out earlier, what we see in most of these projects is most of the people are people of relatively ordinary incomes, or even sometimes low incomes, who once in a while have a trip that is really so important that the value of getting somewhere on time is greater than the amount of the toll. And that is a huge benefit that the existing system simply cannot provide.
Well, that's all the time that we're going to have for now on this, but this is a subject we will continue covering here on WFAE. Al Austin is a Charlotte City Councilman. Bob Poole is Director of Transportation Policy for the Reason Foundation. And Duncan McFadden is a WFAE reporter. Guys, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon about this.
Very good. Thanks.
We're going to spend the rest of the show on significant changes to how the federal government pays hospitals. The Affordable Care Act has started giving hospitals bonuses or penalties based on readmissions, infections, and quality metrics, including what patients think of the care they receive. The bonuses or penalties are part of Medicare. Jordan Rao has covered these changes extensively for Kaiser Health News. He and I spent 2 days reporting on the patient satisfaction side of the changes at Novant Health Hospitals in Salisbury and Winston-Salem. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning.
And Danielle Lloyd is with the healthcare consulting company called Premier, which is based in Charlotte. She leads the company's policy analysis, including on these changes. Danielle is with us in our studio here. Danielle, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have executives from the big hospital systems in our area. Dr. James Hunter is Chief Medical Officer of Carolina's Healthcare System. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Dr. Sid Fletcher is Novant's Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs for the Greater Charlotte Area. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
Jordan, let's start with what exactly is Medicare now judging hospitals on?
They're judging them on about two dozen or even a little bit more different types of measures. Some of them have been in place for a couple of years. Some of them are new. The major ones are readmissions, which is how frequently patients at hospitals return within a month after they've left for some sort of follow-up where they need extra care. And the hospital there can lose as much as 3% of their payments if too many of their patients return. Then there's a mix of really an olio of different types of measures ranging from patient satisfaction, how patients rated their hospital stays after they left, to mortality rates, to a bunch of other things. And that's the only one where they can win bonuses instead of penalties. About roughly half and half win bonuses, half get penalties. And then the new one is for hospital acquired conditions, which is that something really bad happened to you in the hospital, such as an infection from a catheter that was put in, or you slipped and you fell. And all of these Medicare judges how a hospital did in the past and then adjusts its payment up or down in the future.
Danielle, he mentioned the percentages. How much, you know, sort of in percentages or dollar terms can these add up to?
Sure. In 2017 payment, which is actually what we're dealing with right now, your performance in 2015 decides what your payment's going to be in 2017, it's going to be about 6% of a hospital's Medicare payments. So that for, let's say, a 300-bed hospital could be about $4 million. So that's pretty steep, especially when you think about the fact that Medicare doesn't actually cover the cost of treating Medicare patients. Right now, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission estimates that hospitals lose 9 cents on every dollar spent on treating a Medicare patient. So every cent counts.
And Dr. Hunter, how are the Carolina's healthcare system hospitals in our area doing on these metrics?
We're doing extremely well and have been working on these different areas for a long period of time. So the fact that CMS Medicare has brought in these is just added impetus for the work that we've already been doing and engaged with both regionally and nationwide.
And I would imagine that, and this, I'll get your take on this too, Dr. Fletcher, that the busier hospitals, my understanding is some of those often are the ones that can be more likely to be penalized or to have the infections because you're seeing sicker patients, you're doing more treatments. Has that been the case?
that it is the case, and we see that nationwide, that the safety net hospitals, the academic hospitals, the larger, more complex, are much more likely to get the penalties that are passed down from Medicare.
Dr. Fletcher?
I would just echo some of Dr. Hunter's comments, and that's that at Novant Health, we've been working for a very long time, long before there were these penalties and those sorts of things, because the patients really deserve to have the patient care experience that they deserve, to not get an infection in the hospital and to not have to come back and be readmitted. So a lot of work has gone in on the front end before this ever came into play.
And Jordan, from the folks that you have talked to, I mean, how much of an impact is this having as far as if people are potentially concerned about, you know, these penalties coming to certain hospitals?
For impact on patients, I think that the penalties have definitely spurred hospitals to do a lot more in some of the areas, particularly readmissions. Hospitals used to, or a lot of hospitals, I want to be careful about overgeneralizing, but a lot of hospitals, you know, saw their mission sort of ending at the time that the patient left the door. And because they're now financially on the hook for what happens afterwards, they're more likely to set up follow-up appointments, help them find a doctor if they don't have one. Sometimes they even give free medications to patients who can't afford them, because these are all things that can land them back in the hospital. As both of the medical officers said, hospitals have been working on these for a while. But what's changed is that these were quality issues to a large extent, and now the fact that they come into payment has brought them to the attention of the financial people as well. So you have a larger number of people who have a vested interest in keeping tabs on them.
Danielle, off that point, I mean, how much over the past couple of years as these things have started to set in, has this become a bigger focus or a major focus for the hospitals that you guys work with?
Yeah, well, we've been working on this for, as Dr. Fletcher said, more than a decade now. We actually tested what is now the value-based purchasing program with the government starting in 2003. So we've been at it for a while. But there is obviously growing growing motivation because of the penalties and other programs. For instance, there's also now a technical assistance program called the Partnership for Patients. And we work on that with the government. We have 450 hospitals that do this with us. And we've seen from 2010 to 2013, a 17% reduction in hospital-acquired conditions and a 7% reduction in readmissions. So when you think about that and you translate that into dollars, for just the 450, so those numbers were for all of the 3,700 hospitals. But if you look financially just for the premier hospitals, we've saved $750 million for the government as part of that program.
And with those savings, I guess the idea is that also means better care?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the point, right, is we want to make sure that we're providing patients with the best care possible.
We're going to take a short break here and then rejoin in a couple minutes. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting five-time Grammy winner Mary Chapin Carpenter Saturday, March 7th at Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. Coming up next at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show, new ruling on net neutrality. The next chapter in the battle over net neutrality, an expected new ruling from the FCC to regulate the internet as a public utility. Diane Rehm and a panel of experts will have that conversation at 10 o'clock this morning on The Diane Rehm Show, here on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation today on Charlotte Talks, email us, charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. We're coming right back.
At WFAE's public conversation on end-of-life planning, the discussion was about more than dying and death.
If you think about what type of life you want to have, that's going to influence, you know, very likely the types of choices that you're going to want to make around your dying and death. So for me, it is about...
You can hear the full public conversation and find resources on end-of-life planning and healthcare at WFAE.org.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk. We're discussing how Obamacare has attached strings to the payments hospitals get from the federal government. Jordan Rao is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Danielle Lloyd analyzes policy for Premier, a consulting firm based in Charlotte. Dr. Sid Fleischer is an executive at Novant Health, and Dr. James Hunter is an executive at Carolina's healthcare system. So Danielle, we were talking before the break about how obviously the point of this is to lead to better treatment. Dr. Fleischer, can you give me some concrete examples of how these things can be helping patients get better care?
Well, I would just start with when you look at readmissions, one of the issues that patients face is that coordination of care, which Danielle alluded to earlier. We are working with patients to make sure that that care is coordinated. We are developing patient-oriented delivery systems as part of our population health management tools. Those are going to help make sure that the patients get the communication, the medications that they need, and hopefully prevent readmissions for these not only high cost but high volume things like heart attacks, congestive heart failure, pneumonia.
And Dr. Hunter, the I guess coordination once you're outside of the hospital, getting medications, those sorts of things, how do you help with that? You know, I mean, they're outside of your hospital then.
That's a great question because it is very difficult. Carolina's healthcare system has presence in a lot of areas outside the hospital, doctor's offices and nursing homes and home health, those sorts of things. And so that gives us some advantage, but any single patient is going to see a lot of different providers and have a lot of needs that prior to all this focus, we didn't have much control over and didn't work hard to have control over. So you're looking at the hospital getting a penalty for something that does happen very far outside their walls, and that's new work for us. There's been a number of different things like the Partnership for Patients, and Carolina's healthcare system also participated in that, the Hospital Engagement Network, and it worked on a number of things, including readmissions. And Carolina's ended up being the number one ranked 10 Hospital Engagement Network in the nation. So it can be done, and it's very difficult work.
Jordan, on the readmissions point, what have you seen hospitals do to try to handle this, to make this adjustment once folks are outside their walls?
Well, some of them are getting much closer relationships to post-acute providers, places like nursing homes. Some are even sending some of their own nurses into a nursing home to sort of keep track of the patients afterwards. And you're seeing, you know, it's such a disjointed system right now because the, you know, hospital doesn't talk to your doctor's office very well, and they doesn't talk to, you know, the nursing home. And so some of the bonds are being forged more closely. And of course, hospitals are expanding generally and buying some of these. So there's just a consolidation, both sort of in terms of communication and in terms of actual relationships. And those are the big changes. And then some are just sort of, you know, the changes are just ad hoc. Like I said, just, you know, trying to keep some taps on the patients after they've left.
And then the hospital-acquired conditions, which is another of the metrics. You can basically think of that as infections and other things. Danielle, is that a decent summary?
Yeah, it also falls and bed sores and that sort of thing.
So what about the changes there? What are hospitals doing differently? Because I imagine, you know, infections, these types of things are things that hospitals have always been concerned with. I mean, how do you treat the people who are inside?
Yeah, well, certainly with hospital-acquired conditions, we know that if you really vigilantly follow the best practices, that you can really make reductions in those rates. So, for instance, we were talking about earlier, prior to the program, removing catheters really timely and making sure you get those out as soon as you can really reduce urinary tract infections, reduce bloodstream infections, et cetera. So that's part of what we work with our members is making sure that they have all of the best practices that are current, make sure they're hardwired them and doing them every time to the best of their ability.
And are we seeing those numbers go down?
Absolutely. And that's part of the numbers I was citing on Partnership for Patients. Those 3,700 hospitals reduced hospital acquired conditions by 17% between 2010 and 2013. So we're absolutely seeing those numbers move.
And do either of you guys have numbers on what the drops have been either at individual hospitals or in the system generally?
There's been great drops through Carolina's healthcare system, so we've got a lot of different facilities. But as part of the partnership for patients, we actually exceeded 30% reduction in hospital-acquired conditions.
We've had significant decrease at Novant Health across multiple of these hospital-acquired infections in particular. The larger facilities, as you mentioned earlier, certainly have more work to do. Antibiotic stewardship is a very important component of what we do. So we try to make sure that patients get their spectrum of coverage narrowed and to make sure that they're on the antibiotics for the right length of time so that they don't develop other infection related to those antibiotics.
And off of that point, these stewardship programs, tell me if this is right, the idea there is essentially too many antibiotics can be a bad thing, because when you're sort of throwing the kitchen sink at something, that's how you can end up with these bacteria that are resistant, and then you have the bugs like CRE, which some people have probably heard about, which is rare, but which do occur. Too many antibiotics can help contribute to those things.
Right. They can contribute to CRE. They also contribute to a much more common thing that we see, which is Clostridium difficile or C. diff infection, which is one of the HAIs that we're trying to work to reduce.
And that one, C. diff, is that on the list that you guys are now being judged on?
It is.
And have we seen much of a change, Danielle, in those?
Well, we can't tell because it's one
it
of the new.
It doesn't break it out.
It's the new measure.
Okay.
So we don't have the data on it yet.
Okay. And the idea of this saving money as well for both Medicare, which Danielle, you've mentioned, is this also, does this lead to any savings for patients?
Well, certainly they are, to the extent using the example of hospital-acquired conditions, let's say they don't get a hospital-acquired condition, maybe they don't have to go to a nursing home after and they can go straight home. So perhaps they have fewer copays or something like that. So it definitely can spill over to a financial benefit to the patients to the extent that we're able to improve care.
How much do you guys think that patients are aware of these changes?
I don't think that they're fully aware of it. I think rightly they come to the hospital expecting that we're doing it, have been doing it, and we're focused on it, and we are. So I don't think the patients themselves think about this a whole awful lot.
Jordan, your coverage at Kaiser Health News has been particularly good at making this stuff easy to find online. Do you know how common it is for folks to actually go on and check to see if the hospital they go to or the ones in their area, got bonuses or penalties or how they're doing?
It's hard to totally generalize, but I think that for the most part, the evidence, not just on the financial stuff, but since 2006 or 2007, Medicare has been putting up the quality scores on Hospital Compare, and the evidence tends to be that for the most part, people aren't, really carefully looking. What seems to be happening the most, I think, is that the hospitals freak out when they get a bad rating, when they get a penalty, when they get rated worse than average in mortality, and understandably so, and that is what's primarily driving the changes is if you're a place, a prestigious teaching hospital, that's part of your brand. You're spending millions of dollars saying that you're delivering great care, and now there's this thing floating out there. And regardless of how many patients are looking at it, they just can't afford and don't want that blemish on their record. But for the most part, people don't spend a lot of time choosing their hospitals. I mean, you have a heart attack, you're not thumbing through, your iPhone trying to figure out where you want to go. You're just like, get me to the hospital. And so there's not as much consumer choice as there would be in, say, like a restaurant, in Yelp rating.
But I think that Jordan picked up on something important is you don't always choose your hospital, but you certainly choose your physician. And we know that the government has plans to put up significantly more information on individual physicians going forward. So that may really change how consumers engage and use these websites.
And I imagine there the big distinction would be, as Jordan and you have both said, emergency situations versus something that's planned out. Say I want to go get my hip replaced. Do you see differences in the numbers for those kinds of things? How well a place does with emergency stuff versus how well a place does if they get to plan out their surgeries in advance?
Well, I mean, I think to Jordan's point, we're looking at all of those measures because no CEO wants to be in the bottom quartile for any measure. It doesn't matter if it's for emergencies or not. So I think they're really working on all of these aspects.
And Jordan, the patient satisfaction side in particular, you're reporting on that. What have you found on the differences in places based on type of facility or emergency versus not?
Well, some of the things that the hospitals are judged on, such as being clean and quiet, places that are more newly built tend to do better. The evidence is looking like that doesn't make as much of a difference when it comes to the other questions that patients are asked, which are things like, how well did your nurses communicate? Was your pain always well received? But places where if you come in through the emergency room, those places tend to have worse patient satisfaction ratings than the places where, you know, you scheduled a knee replacement and you're coming in. So specialty hospitals often do better. And then the other thing is that places that cater in the Northeast, for instance, north of you guys, tend to do worse. And there's a real debate why there's a geographic difference, and some of it is just that, you know, people are crankier in parts of the country. You know, New York City or Chicago, they're just less likely to, you know, give a rave review to a place than, you know, the polite South. But the evidence behind those sort of generalizations is, you know, still not conclusive.
One of the things I'm curious about is, you know, this idea that the specialty hospitals versus your big teaching hospitals, you know, you see differences in the numbers. What does that say to you guys about just the way these ratings are set up? I mean, do you feel like these are fair ways to be rated?
These measures are really difficult, and there's a significant time lag in the data. So the impact in 2015 is based on some patients that go as far back as 2010. Having said that, there's an attempt by Medicare to risk adjust these for a variety of different factors. And so they are attempting to even the playing field, so to speak. But it's still difficult when you get to the extremes of a large academic, a safety net hospital. And so attempts are being made. They're not perfect, but we're all headed in the right direction with these.
Dr. Fletcher?
I would just say that, you know, patients really, we have a duty to those patients to communicate clearly to them, to make sure that they understand their medications, to respond timely to call bells, to treat their pain effectively. And so whether we think that the way that the metrics are set up or not, we really have that duty anyway.
Right. The point is better care.
Correct.
And Danielle, I'm curious, as these ratings were first being discussed and proposed, as you were analyzing the policy, what were your thoughts as you guys were working on this?
Well, you know, we had a big hand in the development of the value-based purchasing program. As I said, we tested some of that. So we're more supportive of that type of model. In that case, there are carrots and sticks, as Jordan said. It's not just the penalties. You also know what your targets are in advance. So you know what you need to get to, and everyone can work together, because it's not this keeping up with the Joneses where you have to do better than someone else. Everyone can collaboratively try to do better. The other thing is that particular program has improvement or achievement. So we don't want organizations who are really at the bottom to not feel like they can ever get to the top. So it's important to have those sorts of combinations. So we think the value-based purchasing program, because of those aspects, is set up in a way that's a bit better than things like the hospital-acquired conditions that just draws a line every year and somebody's always in the bottom quartile, someone's always in the penalty box. We think that that's just not as effective, and that over time we're going to need some refinements to these programs.
To help kind of take a step back from the program. So the value-based program, that is essentially the one that is patient satisfaction and the other quality metrics there?
Yes. Yeah, so it's to be efficiency, safety, outcomes, and things like mortality, right, and the patient satisfaction that you mentioned.
As compared to the other ones like the hospital-acquired conditions or the readmissions rates?
Right. So those are two very narrow programs, and they're structured differently. So the hospital-acquired conditions, it's just the worst performing quartile is applied that 1% penalty. So every year somebody's in the penalty box.
Whereas with the value-based purchasing, that's not necessarily the case?
Nope. They set the targets in advance, and everyone has the opportunity to get over those. So theoretically, everyone could. Of course, not everybody does. So those who are penalized create a pool of funds that then go to paying bonuses to those who do well. So it not only encourages people to move up from the bottom, it encourages people to stay in the top.
And moving forward, for you guys, I mean, how much is this leading to kind of long-term, are these leading to any sort of structural shifts, or are these more just, you know, you're doing the readmissions things, you're reaching out to people outside of the hospitals? Is this a new path, so to speak, or are we kind of tweaking around the edges here?
No, this is a focus on the work that we've been doing at Carolina's healthcare system for a long time. So it's an increased focus. There's no real structural change. It's not new or different work for us.
I would say much the same at Novant. I would say that there are a number of advantages or things that we're going to be utilizing that will help us, including just like at Carolina's, the electronic health record is going to be incredibly important for transparency across that spectrum of care. So when they leave the inpatient setting and go to outpatient, how do we keep that care coordinated? That will help us with that.
And the electronic records, were there changes within the Affordable Care Act that emphasized those as well?
There were actually changes in a different bill called High Tech that created something called the Meaningful Use Program. They want to make sure that it's not enough to just have an electronic health record. You actually have to use it, right? Sort of thinks it goes without saying to the average person, but that's the way bills in D.C. work, right? So it creates a bonus system at first, but in 2015, it converts to a penalty. So those penalties actually layer on to all of these programs that we've just talked about.
We are getting towards the end of the show right now, so we will go ahead and wrap up there. Jordan Rao is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Danielle Lloyd analyzes policy for Premier, a consulting firm based in Charlotte. Dr. Sid Fletcher is Novant Health's senior vice president for medical affairs in the Charlotte area. And Dr. James Hunter is chief medical officer of Carolina's healthcare system. Everybody, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is